Welcome to Walter Edges Journal. Today, my guests are from Charleston. We've got Rebecca Wesson-Darwin, who is founder, president, and CEO of Garden & Gun magazine, and David DiBenedetto, who is editor-in-chief. And we're going to talk about this magazine, which is almost a decade old, a very interesting story, a niche magazine in the time when everybody seems to be going digital. So with that kind of long introduction, Dave and Rebecca, welcome to the journal.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And I always like to talk about folks for just a little bit. And Rebecca, you grew up here in Columbia.
I did.
Talk about that for just a second. Because there are folks out there who took economics classes from your dad.
Yes. William Wesson, or Bill Wesson, as he was known. I did. I grew up in off of Trenum Road, went to A.C. Flora High School, and had a wonderful childhood here with my parents, who were very involved in the city of Columbia, and my dad at the university, and my mother was very, very involved with foreign students here in Columbia.
So how did you end up in Charleston founding a magazine?
Well, I decided to go to that other Carolina when I went to college. So I moved up to Chapel Hill for 4 years while I was in school there, and then decided that I wanted to go live in New York for a year. And having had a father who was a professor, I knew the way to get him to pay for me to live in New York was to go to school. So I found this little fashion merchandising school that I went to for a year, and had intended to go to law school afterwards, but I was offered an internship at GQ while I was at that school, and then offered a job when I graduated from that school. And so that 1 year in New York turned into many, many years, and I literally just fell into the magazine business there.
And what were you doing with GQ?
Well, I started out as the person who found out who what stores were selling what we were showing in the pages of the magazine. But I moved on from that position, up the ranks, kind of moved into ad sales, became marketing director of GQ. And then GQ was owned by Condé Nast Publications and the Newhouse family. And when Cy Newhouse acquired The New Yorker in the 80s, I was asked to go over to The New Yorker, where I ultimately became publisher of The New Yorker magazine. That was probably my dad's proudest moment ever, since he so loved that magazine. And then ultimately, I worked at other companies. I worked at Time Inc. I worked with Rupert Murdoch.
You had the idea for Garden & Gun actually in New York, right?
No. What happened was that my husband, who was a television producer in New York, decided to go to seminary. And so we moved to Princeton for 4 years. And then when he took a call, he ended up taking a call with a church in Charleston, South Carolina, called Second Presbyterian. And so I got to come back home a little bit, that were at least closer to home. And a couple of years after being there, things kind of all fell into place for me to start the magazine. But that's a longer story, so.
Okay. And Dave, what about you?
I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, on Wilmington Island, which lucky, idyllic childhood where the backyard was the Wilmington River. And I spent a lot or almost all of my free time in boats. When I wasn't reading, I was out in a boat. And I was one of those kids that, for whatever reason, knew what they wanted to be when I was young. You know, when I was in sixth grade, I remember sitting down, was watching TV with the family, and I had this urge to go write a story. And I went up to my room and pulled out a sheet of loose leaf, and I wrote about the things that I knew, which were boats and dolphins and adventure. And from that moment on, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. There was a satisfaction I had from doing that that can't explain where it came from. No other journalists or writers in my family. But from that moment on, I started heading towards the journalism path. And I went to school at the University of Vermont. I loved the South, but I decided I would check out the rest of the world while in college. So I went up to the University of Vermont. And after 4 very cold years there, I, like Rebecca, went to New York to be in magazines. And I got an internship with a magazine called Men's Journal and was there for a number of years. I spent 12 years in the business in New York before I was very, very fortunate to get the opportunity to come down and work with Rebecca at Garden & Gun. And I jumped at the chance.
You were glad to get back down south.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't. I mean, I would have walked down here if I had to. I was. It was it was amazing. There was this magazine that I had never heard of, and 6 months before, I had never heard of it. It had only been around for about a year, and it was everything I loved about the South. You know, there it was in the pages, and the potential was tremendous. So I jumped at the opportunity.
Okay. Well, let's launch Garden and Gun. Let's first of all talk about the name. Rebecca, how did you come up with the name? I mean, you know, most folks know that there was a restaurant, actually it was a gay bar, on the side of the Omni, which was called the Garden and Gun.
Right, right. Well, let me step back just a little bit and tell you kind of how this all did come to happen. So when we moved to Charleston, which is now, I guess, 12 years ago, I had two very small children and really didn't entertain the fact that I was going to do anything in the magazine business living in Charleston, South Carolina. I thought I was going to be the minister's wife and I was going to raise my children. But I found myself pretty quickly, you know, sitting on the room and coloring with them for more than about 30 minutes. I would find myself drifting into my office and cruising around on my computer and researching something. Anyway, in the midst of this, I met Pierre Manigo, whose family owns the Post and Courier and, you know, a group of newspapers and television stations. And Pierre is chairman of the board of the Evening Post Publishing Company, and he had had this vision of the newspaper company branching more into the magazine world and other ventures. So he asked me to come and consult with the newspaper on a magazine that they were doing at the time called Low Country Living, which was inserted into the newspaper. And I kind of said, no, I really don't want to work. I just want to take time with my children. But I found more and more the 5 hours a week became 10 hours and then 20. And consulting on this magazine called Low Country Living. And about a month into it, I said to Pierre, you know, I think that newspapers do what they do very well, and magazines are a very different discipline. And I think if we really want to do a magazine, we should create a magazine division of the company and not just try to fix, you know, this magazine that they were doing. And so he had been bouncing around an idea of, you know, more of a sporting kind of magazine about the South for a number of years. I had come to really believe, because so many of my friends, when I had come back to the South, had said, Rebecca, why don't you start a New Yorker of the South? Mm-hmm. I had come to believe that there was a void in the marketplace, that there needed to be a really good magazine that showed Southern culture in its best light. And that there are a number of very sophisticated people who not only live in the South or who have visited the South or who are used to live in the South that want to see the South. They want to read about what's going on in the South and in Southern culture. And so the two of us kind of came together, and now I'll explain the name and then we can go into a little bit more of how it evolved. But someone had suggested the name Garden and Gun. When I heard those two words, to me, it said exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to do a magazine that was really about the land, because if you think about the South, everything that comes out of it, the music, the art, the culture, of course, the sporting life, come out of the land and the resources that we have here. And then the gun said the sporting piece, which is a big piece of what we do in the magazine and has certainly always played a role in the magazine. So to me, it was the perfect name. And then, you know, I did do a little research and find out about the Garden and Gun Club, which was, I believe, to be like the Studio 54 of Charleston at the time. And and it was interesting as I began to kind of roll this idea out and I would talk to people, I'd be at parties and say, well, yes, we're talking about starting a magazine and we're going to call it Garden and Gun. And there would be these gasps like, oh, well, you do know about that club, don't you? And then in the next breath, they would always say, but we all went there. So it really was the place, I think, that in that time when Spoleto had first come to Charleston and there was kind of no after-hours place like that, it was the place to be. And I never did a lick of research on it, just decided that's what we're going to call it and okay. Go for it.
Since you've worked for GQ, had you thought about maybe G&G at some point?
Absolutely. That's what I said. I think that people will refer to this magazine as G&G, and they do. I mean, you hear the words now. People say, oh, we went to a party. It was very G&G, or we want to have a G&G wedding. You know, so, yes, it has become part of the lexicon.
And Dave, let's talk about your association. You came on board after about a year?
Yeah, it was about a year, and I was working for Time Inc. at a magazine called Saltwater Sportsman, where I was the editor. And I had been there for about 4 years, and at that time, I think I started at around age 34. So young to have that position, but a nice spot for me to be, certainly in my wheelhouse, and I didn't think I would be leaving anytime soon. And a good friend of mine and mentor, Sid Evans, was someone that Rebecca was pursuing as the to be the editor of Garden and Gun. And he came to me and we talked a lot about, you know, would he leave, should he leave? And when he decided to leave, he came in to tell me and I said, well, if you need a number two, I'd be delighted to go with you. And basically on the spot, he said yes, and I was on my way to Charleston. And so I worked with Sid for about 4 years before Sid moved on and I became editor-in-chief of the magazine.
He moved to Southern Living?
He did. Yes.
Which is quite a very different magazine. And I think we might want to take a moment to talk about the difference. It's not just subject matter. It's also who your audience is.
Yes. Before that, I just want to add that when Sid came down, the New York Times ran a piece that said that he was committing career suicide to leave his post at Field & Stream as editor-in-chief and come to this little startup down in Charleston, South Carolina. But, you know, when I worked on the original business plan of the magazine and convinced the Evening Post Publishing Company to fund us because they were our original funders, the thing that I said is, first of all, I have no interest in doing a magazine that just is going to be a Charleston-based magazine. We have a very fine magazine in Charleston Magazine. We don't need that. What I want to do is a national magazine that it happens to be about a region, about the South. And to do that, the toughest thing is going to be hiring the best people that we can to do this magazine. And so hiring people like Sid and Dave and everyone who is on our team, that's really been a critical part of the success of this magazine, is getting the people who did have the Southern roots and the connections, but who really were sophisticated and knowing how to put together a really quality magazine. And it's paid off for us, certainly, in the success of the magazine and the awards that we've won. But to Southern Living, I mean, that was certainly something that I looked at in starting the magazine, knowing that Southern Living is a big machine, you know, a very large circulation magazine. But I felt like I also wanted to start a magazine that men and women would both like. I also thought the name said that. To me, Garden and Gun also said the male-female thing. And I love to hear about couples who get the magazine and fight over who's going to get to read, you know, when the magazine comes in the mailbox, who gets to read it first. So, you know, we are very, I think, very different. And there's definitely was room for another magazine in the Southern category of magazines because we do skew a little bit more male than female. And Southern Living is definitely a, you know, more of a female-focused magazine and covers different topics.
Yeah. And before you all came on, there had been efforts to do other niche magazines. I don't want to say in opposition to Southern Living, but in addition to Southern Living, and they all just folded.
Went right.
6 or 8 years and
right.
Just couldn't make it.
You got to have stick-to-itiveness.
Yeah, and certainly Garden and Gun, I like to think of it about filling the white space. There was nothing quite like it. You know, there was an open spot for this magazine, and we were talking to folks who hadn't really been spoken to, and they appreciated it. They appreciated the way we celebrated the South. They appreciated the way that we understood the South and the South that they knew. And certainly the mix of the content really brought a lot of people in.
In their language, too. I think, you know, one of the things I looked at was that I knew that the people who were going to read this magazine probably read Departures or Condé Nast Traveler or The New Yorker or what, you know, they read very sophisticated upscale magazines. But when they looked at those magazines, they didn't see themselves reflected in the pages of those magazines because I worked for many of those magazines and their concentration is primarily on the Northeast and the West Coast. And there is a whole nother world, as we know, out there.
And we have our own accent as opposed to the Midwest, which has none.
Right. Right. There's a wonderful quote from Clyde Edgerton in our book, our first The Southerner's Handbook, that basically says, you know, if I had been born in the West, I would just be a Westerner. But bottom line, he says, but I was born in the South.
Yeah. Well, having directed Southern Studies for 35 years at the university, you have some group that does New England studies. There are a few places that do Western studies. There are about 4 or 5 schools that have Southern studies. Mm-hmm. Midwestern studies?
Not so much.
You know.
Well, we're spreading there, so I have to be nice. We originally didn't include Texas in our footprint simply because we just didn't have the funds to really distribute the magazine there nor really cover it. And then the Texans put up a big hue and cry, and so we added Texas to what we covered. And then Maryland started lobbying us that they wanted to be considered a part of what we covered, and so we added a little Maryland. And most recently, Oklahoma has been pushing hard. I think the lieutenant governor and others have written letters to me, and so we decided to add a little southern Oklahoma every once in a while.
Well, what is the South, which is what John Shelton Reed has been covering for years.
Right.
And he and I were at a conference at the University of Thessaloniki in Greece about 10 years ago. And this got to be a topic of discussion. And he brought out the Southern Living footprint, where their subscribers were. And you had purists in European scholars who said, oh, the South can only be the Confederate States. Well, I mean, that's not true to begin with. And then somebody threw in Oklahoma, and I thought this scholar from Denmark and scholar from Germany were going to have a stroke right there on the spot. And John and I had to explain, well, you know, Oklahoma actually was part of the Confederacy.
Right. Well, you know, the reality is that the magazine is really about a lifestyle. And so you can identify with that lifestyle wherever you might live. And at this point, and it's really been pretty true from almost the second or third year of the magazine, about 45% of our circulation is outside of the Southeast. So,
as you know, there are huge expat Southern enclaves in New York City. I would say Washington, although many people consider Washington a Southern city, Chicago, and L.A.
And that, you know, in the April, May issue, we did a big feature on the Southernness in L.A., and we've gone to New York, we've gone to Chicago, and in our minds, really, if we can find the DNA of the South in these places, then let's explore it and enjoy it.
And then, of course, you've got people like the Lee brothers, who started out in New York City as part of that group.
The peanut culture.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
They made boiled peanuts cool long before anyone knew it was coming.
Well, this is a Vermont story. You went to University of Vermont. I spent a semester at Middlebury. Ah. And when I left, I had a party for all my Vermont friends. Well, I had boiled peanuts. And, of course, it was the usual thing is people sticking their hands in and putting the whole peanut in their mouth. But I was able to pull it off because in those days there was a flying pig, and I had barbecue flown in from South Carolina.
Right.
And peanuts. And we had some collards, but it was the peanut thing. They just couldn't figure out what.
But you were way ahead of your time. I mean, if you threw that party now, you'd be totally cool.
Yeah, that was 1986.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we've got the magazine founded, and you've kept a pretty lean staff, right?
Yes.
From the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We, we started fairly small, and then we this thing called 2008 and 2009 came along, and at that point, the Evening Post Publishing Group decided that they couldn't continue to fund the magazine, that they really needed to focus on their newspaper business, their primary business. And so at the end of 2009, I found myself potentially having to fold the magazine and tell the whole staff to go home. But instead, I decided we can't let this happen. We've got too much of a good thing going on here. And so I went to Pierre Manigo and I said, you and I need to buy this magazine and keep it going. And so we did. And through very, very dark days, managed somehow to keep the thing alive. I often wonder how we did it. But through that time, we did have to, pare back the staff a little bit. We asked our writers to please be patient, that we would pay them as soon as we got paid by advertisers, which was very, very slow. You know, we made it through the dark times, but it was not without lots of trials, including the fact that I made the toughest decision I think I've ever made in my life, which was to actually skip an issue of the magazine.
Well, I was going to say, I heard about that, and you actually wrote subscribers a letter, didn't you?
Right. Well, in the next issue of the magazine, I wrote a letter explaining why we had had to do that. I, in hindsight, think it was one of the best things that I ever did because it created this amazing bond with the readers that I think that they learned that we were honest, that we were trustworthy, that what they would read in the magazine, that, you know, that the editors put in the magazine was really something that they could bank on. But I have to, one of my favorite stories is the I received a letter during that time from a gentleman who said, "Dear heroes and heroines, if you ever close this magazine down, I will hunt you down and shoot you."
It's true.
And with a name like Garden and Gun, I was, you know, I took that quite seriously. So, no, he had a little wink at the end. But it was true that our readers were so engaged with this magazine at this point. And we had created a club during this time, a Garden and Gun club, for where people paid us to be basically a subscriber to the magazine and get invitations to some special events that we did. They did it because they wanted to be with us, but they also did it because they loved this magazine. And they thought that their $500, which at that time was very valuable, was going to keep us alive. And because of that, those are people who we still know, who come to everything that we do, who we our friends on Facebook with, that we, you know, send Christmas cards to, our family Christmas cards. And so it was really, really tough. But long story short, I think when other magazines around us were closing, I mean, big, big names like Gourmet and, you know, incredible magazines
Domino.
Were folding, we stuck with it. And I think that we came out of it so much stronger, and it really showed the, you know, the vitality of this brand that we were building. And so, yes, we do things a little bit more leanly than other people do, but that's not good English, leaner. But anyway, Dave will correct me
well,
later.
Well, you know, there was a time during, you know, during that period where when it was rough that the color printer broke at the office, and it was going to cost a bit to fix it. And those funds weren't readily available. So we were printing a magazine without a color printer. And if you tell this to anyone who's in the business, they think you're crazy. How, you know, you have to see your layouts. You have to see what they look like. We would just take a thumb drive down to Kinko's, and they, you know, they would print it for us. But, you know, we all of us who came through that time, and there are still probably four or five on the editorial team who are, let's see, three or four on the editorial team who were there, have a bond. I mean, we all wanted this magazine to survive. I mean, we had total buy-in, and still do, in believing that we're doing something that's just better than a print publication. It means so much to so many people. We wanted to give our all, and to be honest, none of us wanted to leave Charleston. I certainly didn't want to move back to New York.
Now the truth comes out. But you know what I wouldn't sacrifice during that time was quality. And so, you know, I was not going to change the paper stock. I wasn't going to cut the trim size of the magazine. We were not going to not to use the best writers and the best photographers. And I would have rather closed the magazine than to have done that. And so while it was heresy in some sense to skip an issue, particularly with advertisers, because then they, on the other hand, lose faith in you and think that you're not going to be around, by building up this relationship with the reader, who, by the way, is an incredible reader when it comes to demographics and who advertisers want to reach, that was just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And so when we came out of that, all of a sudden advertisers started to pay attention and say, aha, they really do have something here that's worth investing in.
So do you handle your own advertising in-house, or are you really your marketing in-house?
Yes. We have a large marketing team, and we, in terms of advertising sales, we have a publisher in Charleston and a small team in Charleston, but we have independent reps around the country, and then we have several offices like in New York. I mean, we have several people in New York because it's a big ad market for us. We have people on the West Coast.
Well, I have read your issue that had LA in it. I noticed you've got advertisers that are not just in the South. I mean, you've got a national advertising
right.
band.
Which is, you know, what I expected the magazine to do from the beginning. And yet we still, what I love about Garden and Gun, and I think my father would appreciate this because he loved the New Yorker so much, and he loved, you know, the beautiful national ads, but he also loved the small ads that were in the New Yorker. And I think Garden and Gun is similar to that in that we, you know, you'll see a lush ad for some, you know, very expensive item, but you'll also see the peanut Peanuts from Virginia advertised. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see, you know, a beautiful shotgun advertised. So it's this great mix of really representative of what the magazine is all about. We've always said we're about the high and the low. And we we actually have a column in the magazine called The High and the Low. So, you know, you're just as likely to read about that incredible shotgun in the magazine as you are about the barbecue joint where you can get the sandwich for 75 cents.
Hey. All right, we have to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to Rebecca Wesson-Darwin and Dave DiBenedetto about Garden and Gun magazine. I want to go back to the L.A. thing because this is something that, again, the Southern Studies Forum, which is a transatlantic group of academics that deal with the South, years ago the idea came up that Walter Mosley's Easy Rollin' stories set in L.A., are really Southern stories. And again, you had this, how can you possibly have that? But, of course, E.Z. Rawlins comes from East Texas, Louisiana connection.
Right.
And then the whole L.A. scene in terms of food, in terms of heritage, there are people with real Southern roots who moved out to that part of the country. So. All right. You mentioned your club. Let's talk about that and some of your other endeavors.
Yes, although we disbanded the club a few years ago because we really felt like we wanted to be able to offer what we do to all of our subscribers. But the tradition of what we did with those events carries on. So we started out with an annual event that we had at Blackberry Farm every year where essentially the magazine came to life at a weekend that you could come and spend a lot of money to stay at Blackberry Farm and hang out with some of our writers and editors and, you know, perhaps go shooting with us or fly fishing. But we saw that people really liked that. They liked being together because whether it is technically a club or not, they're people of like mind who like to get together and have a good time together. So out of that, we've done a number of events, including last year, Dave and I were in Bermuda to a sold-out weekend of Garden and Gun readers who came to spend a weekend with us, and the Lee brothers were also there. And Marcus Samuelson came and cooked for us, and it was a really fun weekend. But we can do anything from music weekends to food-oriented weekends to certainly to sporting weekends. I do something called Women in the Field, where I try to get women out who perhaps have not, you know, shot a shotgun before or gone fly fishing before, and women who are very experienced and just get them out experiencing the good old outdoors or a good old clay course. And so those are always fun. But we've evolved into something now called Jubilee, which is our annual event that we just had our third one this past December. We hold it the first weekend in December in Charleston out at Charlestown Landing in conjunction with the Charleston Area CVB. And our new
Charleston Area CBB.
CVB, Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Okay.
And then in the past 2 years, our new resident to South Carolina, Volvo, has joined as a big sponsor of that event, which we're very grateful for and really enjoy working with them. But it is a weekend of shopping, music, sporting activities. Really, again, if you thought about everything that's in the magazine all coming to life, and people just having a really good time. People bring their dogs, they bring their children, they get their holiday shopping done and eat some good food along the way. So we're really known, that we give a good party. Garden and Gun gives a good party. But, you know, from the beginning, I pictured this being not just a magazine, but a lifestyle brand, and knew that there would be other things if we did this right that would come out of all of it coming out of this quality editorial product. We certainly have a presence on the web and a digital presence, which Dave can address better than I can. But, you know, we've done books. We've done 3 books now, including our Southerners Cookbook that just came out this past year, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list. We're you know, looking at a lot of different ways to bring the magazine closer to people, because since we only come out 6 times a year, which I think is good, I think people get just enough and don't feel guilty that they haven't kept up, and yet we want to be in touch with them in between the issues. So whether it's traveling to a different market and doing an event, or having them come to Charleston for Jubilee, or having them read our books, or shop at our mercantile shop, there are a lot of different ways that they can connect with this brand that they love so much.
Rebecca, when you were talking about getting women into the field, I just want to go back to the idea of garden and gun, because, yes, hunting is a big part of male life, but there have always been women in the field. But gardening, and I'm talking about things like raising heirloom camellias. For many years, camellia clubs were an all-male enterprise in the South. So, you know, gardening is not just for
women. No.
For women.
No, and, you know, we don't technically cover, I wouldn't say gardening, but we cover gardens in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And if I think back, and Dave, you think on this too, if you think back of most of the gardens that we have actually featured in the magazine, I would say the majority of the master gardeners or the landscape architects that have done them are male.
Yeah, I would agree.
You didn't mention about your products line, because you do have a mercantile.
Right. Well, we started with an online store years ago, small, where we were selling, you know, baseball caps and T-shirts and a few items that, you know, had the Garden and Gun logo on them. And that evolved into then, I think, Yeti coolers and, you know, started kind of extending the line that way. And it's really grown into a pretty big business for us at this point. I mean, if you go on to our G&G Mercantile site on the web, you can find all kinds of things. That also is very much a part of our Jubilee weekend that we do. Many of the items that we sell in the store are available at Jubilee, as well as bringing in retailers or designers or jam makers or knife makers or whoever from all around the South to be a part of Jubilee. So retail is a big thing for us, and I'm very excited to announce that we are actually going to open our first bricks and mortar store. There's a new hotel in Charleston opening up called the Dewberry Hotel on Meeting Street, and it's going to be a beautiful hotel, and we are going to have two very small spots in it in the lobby called the Feel Shop. And so playing on the garden and gun kind of theme, one of the little shops is going to be more male-focused and more, you know, more kind of the sporting side of things, and then the other more of the garden side of things.
Our seventh annual Made in the South Awards, which is a contest that we have where we invite folks, artisans, chefs, entrepreneurs, to submit products in six different categories that are made in the South. And along with that, tell us their stories. And over the past couple of years, we've been averaging over 1,000 entries per year, which is amazing. And it allows us not only to see and learn about, you know, more products than we could ever write about, but to really celebrate the folks who are doing great things. And, you know, the Made in the South Awards has become, for the entrepreneurs of the South, a marquee event, because the winners, to a T, will tell you that it has really changed their life. But as an editor, there's nothing more rewarding than you can think of when you get to look at these products. We call in, you know, we narrow down from 1,000 products to maybe 15 in each category.
Okay. Do you start off with categories?
Yes. So sorry. That we start off with food, drink, style, home, then the outdoors, and crafts, which is the newest category that we've added. And each of those categories has a judge that we call in who will do the final judging. And when we lay those products out in the magazine, the readers just devour them. I mean, when we talk to these potential winners and we say, are you ready? Because when we run this product in the magazine, you know, your phone's going to ring off the hook, and they say, yes, I'm ready. We say, no, are you really ready? Because this is going to be like nothing you've ever seen. And that really gets back to what Garden and Gun has that a lot of magazines don't, which is such an unbelievable trust. The readers have an unbelievable trust in the pages of the magazine.
Okay, so this isn't the case, and I will not mention the magazines. Somebody is featured because they bought a huge chunk of advertising.
Right. Yeah. We still practice the church and state. You know, it is a line drawn across the office, and that is how it works. I mean, if you know, as you start to do those kind of things, you lose the reader's trust. You know, it just quickly erodes. And if you don't have that, then you have nothing. And we're very lucky at Garden and Gun to have that, and we will do everything we can to keep it. I mean, it is part of the secret sauce. I'm often asked, you know, what is it about Garden and Gun? It certainly starts with a readership who is rabid and who trusts the pages of the magazine.
and your readership continues to climb. Is that a state secret? Or
No. It's we're very proud of that. It's, you know, in a day and age when most magazines are singing the blues that they're not selling copies on the newsstand anymore, we are still doing very, very well on the newsstand. Our circulation continues to grow. I mean, I think this magazine has a, you know, it certainly has potential to grow quite a bit more. I don't want to push this so far that, you know, we lose the beauty of what this audience is all about and this relationship that they have with the magazine. So you started out by saying that we were a niche publication, and that's what we are. And I think if you look at what magazines are doing really well now, it is the niche publications, because they, the mass publications are having a very hard time trying to meet the numbers that they've promised advertisers that they're going to deliver. And so to do that, they are giving away subscriptions, or you can buy, you know, 12 issues of a magazine for $6 a year and get one other magazine thrown in for free. And we don't do any of that. We don't discount our circulation at all. And that's reflected in the quality of who the reader is. I also think, you know, back to the church and state thing, I mean, one of the things, having grown up in the culture in New York of working for the best magazines, that I wanted, as does Dave, I mean, I wanted this to be a magazine that was very well respected in the industry. And it's really like the, you know, you can go down that route of just pandering to your advertisers if you want to, and that may pay off in other ways, but it's not going to win you national magazine awards for general excellence, which we have won. It's a whole nother game, and we're playing the quality game, and I think it's paying off for us.
Well, I think it was in Wall Street Journal did a nice feature on you and talked about not only is your readership growing, but your advertising pages are growing, which is going contrary to the magazine world. And I believe it was in that article where it talked about the average income of your readers is higher than, was it the New Yorker? It was...
It's up, and I, you know, I don't remember the exact number, but we have a very, very high household income number. We also have very high second home ownership, which is, you know, a good thing to have. It's a very affluent audience that is an advertiser's dream.
Yeah, the average income is around $335,000 a year.
Yeah, and this is from the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
It was comparing that figure you mentioned to 294,000 for Town and Country, and 66,000 for Southern Living. You're running against everything that people say, give up on magazines, give up on newspapers. And by the way, Pierre Manigault's not giving up on newspapers. The Post and Courier is
doing, you know, very well and won that award last year.
Yeah. Won a Pulitzer. It may get another one.
Yeah.
They're doing great things. I mean, Charleston's on fire right now in terms of that creative energy. I mean, you feel it in the streets when you walk around, you know, folks you hang out with, meetings you have. I mean, there has been an influx of younger folks with big ideas who are really charging hard and who have realized that you don't have to live in a big city to do these kind of things. And I've been there now coming on 9 years, and it's been just tremendous to see that growth. I mean, the city's really on fire.
Yeah. Well, it is. And, of course, part of that, Joe Riley, his story.
And what they're doing with the Park Conservancy and all of that. I mean, it's a really delightful place to live and to work.
So let's talk about your writers, because it's a who's who of folks who write about the South, whether it's John Shelton Reed or Winston Groom, the Lee brothers. They've all contributed. And so you don't have in-house writers per se.
That's right. I would say that, 95% of the magazine is written by freelancers. And then there are a couple of folks who are go-to folks. Roy Blunt writes a tremendous column, the end of the line column, which is in the last page of the magazine. Julia Reed writes the high and low column. John T. Edge, who's part of the Southern Foodways Alliance, writes an amazing restaurant review, really, every issue. And then there are the guys like Rick Bragg, Winston Groom, who really enjoy writing for Garden and Gun, because we let them tell the stories that they'd like to. You know, they don't get to necessarily tell these stories in other magazines. And it's my philosophy, if there's a great writer who's excited about an idea, then the smartest thing you could do is let them go for it. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's happened. And we also give them the breadth, the number of pages to write about what they need in the right amount of space. I mean, we certainly edit. We don't let stories run on and on. But we give them the room to tell a great story. And that's really what this magazine is. It boils down to. And it's such a Southern thing, is telling great stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not an editor, but from the very beginning of the magazine, just, you know, trying to cobble together a group in the beginning until we were able to go out and hire the right kind of talent to really give form and flow to the magazine. But accidentally, I guess, maybe it was the Southern thing. From the beginning, the magazine has always been about experiences or about stories. It's never been about things or objects. I mean, that's really not what we're about. And there was a piece in the very first issue that Clyde Edgerton wrote about going up flying in a – we let him go up in a light plane. And he had had a plane crash about 20 years before that, and it was his first time to go up in a plane again. And I would say, you know – we're walking up and down the streets of New York trying to peddle this idea of this magazine to prospective advertisers at that point that, you know, this is the difference. We're not the Robb Report, for example. The Robb Report's going to tell you all about that plane, how big it is, how the seats are made of leather, how, you know, how fast it can go and all of that. That was never our approach. Our approach was to let him go and experience the plane and then share that experience with our readers. And we've come a long, long way from that, but it really, that thread has continued consistently throughout the magazine.
Absolutely. And it certainly, when I saw my first issue of Garden and Gun, you know, I appreciated that storytelling. There it was. And the potential in my mind for what you could do was just tremendous. You know, I'll be at the office and the phone rings and it's PJ O'Rourke, who's calling because his bird dog passed away and he'd like to write a, you know, 2,000-word obit. Would it be okay and would I be interested? Well, sure, yes. Thank you, and you made my day. But that's really, you know, the word has gotten out. And PJ lives in New Hampshire, but, you know, talking about Southernness, folks talking about their bird dogs, you know, that's Southern to us. And it's not as if we can't have a conversation with someone who's not from the South.
I think we should talk about dogs, too, because they've been the star of our magazine. We do every year. We put a dog on the one cover every year, and it is always our best-selling cover. And we can do things on the web as well, online, and ask people to, you know, send in photos of their dogs, and we're overwhelmed by the response to that. So dogs and barbecue and bourbon, you know.
Yeah, the Holy Trinity. And we, you know, Rebecca, she's mentioning the good dog column, which has been in the magazine from the very first issue and is certainly the most popular column, the most popular piece in every issue. I mean, Southerners, we love our dogs. You know, they're part of the family. We have those of us who go into the field with them. There's a bond that, you know, you just can't find anywhere else. And great writers, they may not want to write about anything else for you, but if you ask them, are you interested in writing about your dog? They all say yes. And that's really been the beauty of that column, just the level of folks, the level, the talent who have written about their dogs.
Which we turned into a book.
Right, which we turned into a book and which was a New York Times bestseller, which was great.
I don't recall that you've ever done a story about the Carolina dog.
We have not, but I am fascinated, and don't give it away. I'm fascinated with the Carolina dog, and I think it would be a tremendous story. It's always my dream to have Jack Hitt do a piece about the Carolina dog for us. Yeah. And I've seen one in the wild, which I thought was a stray and was later told by a biologist that it was a Carolina dog. Amazing story.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's got one over in Lexington County. He's living on his grandmother's farm, and basically the dog came out of the wild and took up with him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he's taken her to the vet, and yes, she is a Carolina dog. Obviously, she has been. And of course, Lexington over to Aiken is where they find a lot of those Carolina dogs.
Yeah.
All right. It's been almost a decade of Garden and Gun. Looking back, both of you, what's the name? You know, a milestone, some story that just went viral that you weren't expecting.
We ran a piece, it's probably been 6 years ago or so, about Southern women And Allison Glock was the writer. It was an essay. So this was a cover package. And Allison Glock wrote the opening essay about Southern women. And then we highlighted, I think, 20 Southern women, the new Southern Belles, really doing amazing things in the South, celebrating them, obviously. And, you know, Allison said some smart things about Southern women. And, wow, that piece just, you know, we call it the Energizer Bunny. It took off, whether you folks were talking about it on radio shows or on TV, or you would get picked up online again and again and again. I mean, it's still an amazing traffic driver, and it went to show you the power of Southern women for sure.
Yeah, I love to use that piece. I speak quite often to groups of women, and that's kind of the center of what I talk about and read some from the piece, because it's just full of gems of how she describes Southern women and that we're really not as soft as people think that we might be. So, but I, you know, for me, I'm proudest of what we have done to really change people's lives. We were talking about the Made in the South Awards, and Chris Williams was the winner of our first Made in the South Awards. He's a knife maker, and he was in the finance world at the time, and, you know, on the nights and weekends, he would make his knives, and he won our award the first year, and he was able to give up his day job that he really didn't love and to go and build an incredible business. And so when I think about what this magazine has done, it has really brought Southern culture to the forefront, I think, and it has people's stories like his being told. And as I travel around, that's what makes me proudest. I mean, when I open up the New York Times and see yet another article about, you know, a Southern restaurant or Southern chefs, or that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, before Garden and Gun. And I'm not saying that we are totally responsible for that, but I do think that we have made a dent. I think that we're painting a nice picture of what Southern culture is all about.
Which, again, that runs counter to so much of what has... Rebecca, you and I grew up with the South in the movies, the South on TV, right. Hee-Haw, Petticoat Junction... You know,
I liked Petticoat Junction.
I know. But even Mayberry, you know.
We're painting a different picture, I hope.
Yes, you very definitely are. So
thank you.
We've looked back. What about in the future? You talked about four books. You've got your four books out now,
we
right?
We have three books out, and we're currently working on a fourth, which is going to be a, you know, working title, Encyclopedia of the South, kind of a fun romp across the Southern cultural landscape. So that'll be out
from A to Z.
From A to Z, right. That'll be out. Another working title is G is for Grits, which it'll be out in the fall of 2017.
Who's doing that for you?
So HarperCollins. Okay. We published our first three books with HarperCollins, and they were we beat any expectation that anyone there had. And, of course, they were very, very interested in the fourth book.
Well, what I was really thinking is, who's putting it? Is it Bill Ferris? Is it John Shelton Reed?
Got it. Well, those are the kind of folks that we are going to go to do some of the writing for the book, for sure. We have an editor in-house who's working on the book, but we will reach out to all of the great Southern writers and minds to contribute where it's pertinent.
Besides that, anything else?
Well, you know, the 10th year will be huge for us. I mean, we plan to celebrate that, and we're delighted to be here and delighted with our successes. So the April-May issue in 2017 will be our 10th anniversary issue, and we are hard at work on figuring out how that's going to be the best issue ever.
The challenge at this point is there's so many ideas and so many people who want a piece of Garden and Gun at this point. Is really deciding, you know, what is the next right thing for us to do, and who do we pick if we're going to do any kind of partnership with somebody, you know, who is the right person to partner, who is the right company to partner with. So, I mean, that's kind of, I guess I'm kind of the brand chief to, you know, watch out the brand police to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. But because this brand has come to represent more than that club back there in the...
All right. And you're still a closely held company, right?
We are. I have a third partner at this point, Ed Bell, who just bought the law school in Charleston, is our third partner. So Pierre, Ed, and myself own the magazine.
Okay. So that way you really can control, and that's important.
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely.
Very important. And don't want that to change.
Okay. All right. Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. Any last words? And Dave, I'll start with you.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about Pat Conroy on the way up here and his writing and the fact that he was on the first issue of the magazine, and also thinking about what Garden and Gun means, what it means to folks, and why. And I mentioned storytelling and how important that was. And I asked Pat about Southern storytelling, and he told me when this was a number of years ago, he said that Southern writing is simply human writing. And I think that's so true. And so we're putting out a real and authentic magazine, and that's what's nice and refreshing about it. And I think that that is resonating with people.
Okay. Rebecca?
Well, I'll go back to the beginning. You know, having grown up here in South Carolina, I am just... you know, really have to pinch myself that I got to come home and I'm getting to do what I love, and that we're doing it so well, that this team is doing it so well. I do think that my father would be very proud. And I had an email from my sister this morning who lives in Los Angeles, Celeste Wesson, who used to produce a Marketplace most recently and All Things Considered, the weekend edition at one point. And when I started the magazine, I was a little nervous about telling her what the name of the magazine was going to be because she had become fully Californian at that point. And, you know, so but I told her and I sent her the first issue. And she's been nothing but proud ever since either. Her husband is a writer and would love to write for this magazine. And her email today said, you know, just read the LA piece in the magazine. It's fabulous. And you have more fans out here than you know.
Okay. Well, Rebecca Wesson-Darwin and David DiBenedetto, I want to thank you for being with us today on Walter Edgar's Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. This is a fascinating story of a magazine about the South, which is regionally oriented, but it really has a national audience. It's a success story that's running against all of the trends in the publishing world. Readership is up. Newsstand sales are up. Advertising pages are up. And it's based right here in Charleston, South Carolina. It's a celebration of what is really good about the South. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.